We've been working on plans for the development of Glen Eyrie, the construction of new rooms, quite a number of new rooms, a large number of new rooms, more than we have now, and then also some recreational facilities, and then a new international headquarters office. And we plan to provide an up-to-date presentation for you on where we are in our planning and thinking, and also our fundraising plans, because this will involve raising a little money, probably in excess of $2 million, probably less than $3 million. And George, this is scheduled when?
1:30, Mark.
Okay. I wonder if we could see how many of you think you would like to attend this so that we would know whether we should hold it here or in 303. If we can hold it in 303, it might be a little better because we can darken the room and it's a slide presentation primarily. We put all of our information on slides. So maybe we could see a show of hands on how many of you want to see that. Some of you from the Southern Division have already seen it. What we'll present tomorrow is quite similar, although there have been some changes. The Board of Directors last Saturday had a few questions, and we're back to the drawing board on our recreational center. They felt that we were spending a little too much on that, and it was elaborate, and so we're working that whole plan over again. So how many of you would plan on seeing this tomorrow? Well, we could hold it in 303 then. Can we set it up there? Okay, we'll meet in 303. Now, our purpose this morning in discussing personnel policies is to identify the principles that lie behind the policies, and perhaps even to discuss some of the history behind these. A principle, of course, is a comprehensive, fundamental law or assumption or doctrine. So it's comprehensive and it's fundamental. And a policy is something that provides a definite course of action to guide in decision making. A policy is something that brings order out of circumstances that would otherwise be chaotic. And policies are essential when there is decentralization. They are particularly critical in circumstances where decisions are being decentralized. We all need guidelines then in order to know how to make our decision. And the policy sort of forms a framework for us. And within that framework then we can make decisions. And without them there would be a lot of confusion. So that's what we plan on doing this morning, and I thought we'd start out with this page that we passed out, which would be the number one page, really, in your policy manual, beginning with the title Definition of Staff. And if you'll read that number one, think about that for a moment and see if you can identify the principle behind that. See if you can recall the reasons for this. Would someone like to venture a thought on this? What do you think would be a principle behind this policy?
Maybe you could give us an example, Ron. I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
All right. Here's the principle. I'll just give you the principle. The principle is that the NAVs will be inclusive rather than exclusive, and that we will be broad rather than narrow. At least it's a step in that direction. And I'm sure that if the Christian public could tell us their impression of the navigators, many of them would feel that we were narrow and exclusive rather than inclusive. And just by virtue of our approach to the ministry and our objectives, we exclude many people. And so here is... At this particular level in our organization, we want to open our arms and we want to be inclusive rather than being exclusive. And so we're saying the official navigator staff will consist of all official representatives and persons employed by them. And this comes out of a background where the only official navigator staff members were representatives. And if you were not a navigator representative, you weren't a navigator. See, that's exclusive. And many of us who worked over here in the headquarters office on that basis, see, we weren't really navigators unless we had become area representatives at some point in our lives. And so here's an effort on our part to be a little more inclusive. And now we're saying that anybody who is hired by a navigator representative and on up is navigator staff. It's all inclusive. And there was a day, I can remember, the year that we came to Colorado Springs for our staff conference, we rented the Young Life facilities on the other side of town here at Star Ranch. And we had a basketball game one day, and it was staff against the non-staff. And I said to Leroy, I said, come on over here and play on our side. And Leroy says, from that day on, I was a navigator staff member. And anybody who ever wanted to know, I just told them, yes, I became a staff member when Rod said, okay, Leroy, play on this side of the net. Well, you know, for years we didn't know who was staff members and who weren't. Any questions on that? Bob.
One question. Does this make a distinction between nav staff and navigator employee? I'm thinking, for instance, of people like Dr. Bob Bremner and so forth. How do they fit into... Are they official nav staff? They're not representatives. They're not employees. Just a question that...
I would say that we would probably not say that Dr. Bremner was a staff member. He is self-employed, but if he were to give up his practice and receive contributions, then he's certainly spending as much time as many of us at the ministry. So from a technical point of view, we'd probably say that, no, he's not a staff member.
Rob, is the word employed, can that be used... large sense of the word, that a regional director employs a student at a college campus as a contact point or as contact, and he is an official navigator representative, using the term, and not an official navigator representative.
Well, this is a many-sided coin, and this is one reason why we finally came to this policy to try to make it a little more inclusive. But, for instance, we have to decide who's going to be on our Mutual of New York major medical policy. And so one of the guidelines they gave us was that a person who spends, I think the guideline was 30 hours a week or more in navigator ministry, they certainly qualify as an employee. So that would be one way to look at it. Now, if you take a look at it from the standpoint of the public, we have a man on the campus. The man you describe is out here on a campus, and he's doing the navigator ministry, and he is the navigators to everybody who knows him. And no matter how you cut it, he's an employee from their point of view. He is a navigator. From a technical point of view, he may not be. So this is, it just depends on what the issue is, what side of the coin you're looking at it from. The second policy here, we will recruit and grow our own staff rather than taking applicants from the general Christian community's conventional training environment. Now, this is both a policy and a principle, but why do you think we have this as a policy? What are some of the reasons behind this?
Keep peace in the family.
Ken said to keep peace in the family. Yes, this is a great aid to family spirit and to loyalty. No doubt about that. Helps promote unity.
Just our vision and the fact that it has to be reproduced down and the fact that we grow into business.
Okay. Harv.
If we're going to fly our own flag, how else would you do it?
Well, I don't know. How else would you do it? Anything else?
Breeds confidence in each other.
Yes?
Also appreciation for other works, too.
How's that?
Well, we're not going to recruit people out there.
Oh, I see. Right. Yeah, we don't steal their best people. Yeah, all they have to do is look at us and they know we've never done that.
We don't have to take some things out of someone and then, you know, program
oh.
things in.
Yeah. They don't have to be debriefed and then retrained, you mean? Okay.
There was a danger in it. They found a big business like Philip Petroleum doing that. They got him grown and produced yes men. The organization had problems. So there could be some negatives in there. We don't get a broad enough perspective.
Do you think we're producing some yes men in the Navigators? I'm serious. Do you think so? How many of you think we are? Well, let's see those hands. Let's get them up there. Oh, we're in the minority. But I would say we are definitely doing this. I think that in some instances we're able to move away from it, but I think that there is that this is sort of built in. We have a propensity to tell men to play the game. Oh, and listen, I have a letter here. I want to read this letter. This arrived yesterday. This applies to this situation, and it also applies to another principle that I have here, but this is from a captain. He says, I've been a Christian for about 3 years now, and I want to express my appreciation to the Navigators for helping me to continue maturing spiritually. I am particularly indebted to and impressed by Mr. George So-and-so, who spent a tremendous amount of personal time working with me when I returned from the Republic of Vietnam. I believe the Navigators are the major evangelistic force in the world at this time, and I'm concerned, however, with the tendency of Navigator personnel to show a low tolerance for individual style and personality. Lately, when I'm trying to get something straight in my mind, they think I'm arguing. And so instead of getting a straight answer, I get remarks like, the only way to do this is the way I've just told you. If you don't agree, you lack discipline in your life. Or, you must submit yourself unquestionably to your spiritual leader. Now that is producing yes men. That is sad. That eats my lunch. He says, if you're working with a young kid, especially if he's living in your home, perhaps this is a good approach. But for an adult, this does not cut it. These kind of flippant remarks implies near perfection on the part of the person who states them. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm just another sinner saved by grace. And there are probably three areas of my life that need maturing: physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Most Navigators have got the spiritual part down a lot better than I, so I can always learn from them about spiritual things. On the other hand, I have met Navigators who could stand a little growing in the other two areas. What I'm saying is that wherever I can, I'd like to contribute more than just my money. Couldn't the Navigators be just a little more patient and understanding with their friends? George So-and-so, this man's last name I won't mention because some of us know him, George was always like that, and I would seek and follow his advice anytime. But this is the kind of thing that this is one of the reasons that we have training in the Navigators, isn't it? So that we can resolve this kind of problem. And this is the kind of thing I think that happens with our younger men and with men who are insecure. They feel insecure when someone doesn't fit the pattern. And when they see them doing things a little differently, it spooks them. and they want to get that guy back in the mold, then they'll feel comfortable. Then if their area rep or their R&D comes by and they see the man in the mold, they think, ah, yes, well, so-and-so is doing a good job. One of the reasons for this policy, Dan, were you going to comment on that?
Well, yeah, just a little comment on this. It seems that in looking around the staff a little bit and evaluating how some of us have come on, that the facts are that we haven't grown all of our own all the way. We've grown part of them some of the way.
Right, right.
And so there is a little bit of an open door there for people that we bring in, and we sometimes don't give credit for what was done in other areas. And mm-hmm. I think in many cases, perhaps the major part was done outside the navigators.
That's true. That's very true. And I think some of the men who are able to make very significant contributions to the navigator, to our organization, are those who come with experience from the outside.
I think a key word in this is applicants. The general Christian community's conventional training environment seems to be like a Bible school or a seminary or some training situation like that. And maybe a principle backing this policy up is that you can't really tell all there is to know about a man through an application. But you have to get to know him personally over a period of time.
All right, good. One of our objectives is to produce new laborers, isn't it? If we get our people out of the Bible schools or out of the churches, we're not really producing new laborers. So one of the basic principles behind this policy is that one of our objectives, our purpose, is to produce new laborers for the body of Christ. And then it's also true, this principle, this policy is necessary because the general Christian community does not produce the kind of individual that we need to fulfill our vision.
Would you say that statement, I don't know about, if you say the general Christian community does not produce, wouldn't you say more like in itself it does not produce it? Because I think a lot of the people here are from that type of background.
Yes, I'm not saying it doesn't. It's not productive. I am saying it does not produce the kind of individual that we need. And I'm thinking here in terms of our vision and our know-how. They do not know how, generally speaking, to reproduce themselves spiritually. Does that clarify it? Yeah, it's not that the Christian community is not productive. They're very productive, of course, and they're turning out some very capable Christians and some very productive and fruitful Christians. But I was thinking in terms of the Navigator context. All right, on staff appointments. Number one, area representatives are appointed by a divisional director. What is the principle behind this? Do you see a principle here? Harb.
Chain of command, order.
Let's see.
There has to be some kind of chain of command in the situation, family, ministry, and so on.
Ken, all right.
Delegation of authority from the president to the DD.
Yes, the principal, perhaps the one closest to the issue here is that of decentralization of authority and decision-making. The delegation of that decision is made. The president used to make all those decisions. And, of course, those of us who were around in Dawson's day, we remember that almost every decision crossed his desk. And so we've seen that era, and now we've come into an era where we have seen that many of the decisions that Sandy made and used to make up until 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 years ago, those decisions are now being made not at headquarters but out in the areas. And from my personal point of view, I'm rather impressed with the progress that Lauren has made in decentralization and in the delegation of the decision-making process. Now, I don't know how it looks to you. In fact, I think it would be interesting to ask you the question, how does it look from your point of view? From where you sit as you look at the decision-making process and the delegation of responsibility and so on, do you feel that this is moving along in balance, or do you feel we ought to be doing more of this?
Craig? I feel more and more isolated from the rest of the work. I feel very much part of my own division, but cut off from the rest of the division because of that particular central action.
Right. I think that's the way we all feel. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's part of growing and expanding. We feel like we don't know what is going on in the navigators.
A corollary with this, it's much easier to question the actions of the other divisions. It's easier to pick up impressions. You don't know the thinking behind something, so you pick an impression and criticize or evaluate it.
Right. Yeah. We were talking recently, and Lauren's observation is that too many of us are experts in the other man's area, in the other man's region, in the other man's division. We can tell him how he ought to be running it. And we're doing this a little bit too much. That's a good point.
And along with that, there was a time a few years ago when movement within divisions was quite free. However, with decentralization, the autonomous unit now seems to be the regional boundaries, and to cross them is a federal case. And I think as decentralization continues, that's one of the difficulties of it. Of course, I enjoy the freedom that we have and the local flavor that we get as a result of it. But another one of the tensions, of course, is that the division director appoints his area representatives, and if this continues long enough without centralized control somewhere, each of the divisions will take on a character unique to its own, and it will get harder and harder to cross people from division to division boundaries. And if this continues to go down, it will soon be the same in region to region. So it seems to me that this is a very mixed blessing and requires someone in a seat of power to keep this thing in balance.
Yes, that's a good observation. And for every step of decentralization, you need corresponding steps of centralization and to add the balance. And I'm sure that we are going to be struggling with this, with the problem that you've defined. And maybe we've tossed this around a little bit from time to time and thought maybe we could just switch divisional directors and put them in charge of a new division. But I'm sure there are more realistic approaches to... to working on that problem. Were there some more comments that someone that wanted to be made here on this point?
We already have with regional directors and the rest of the moving into different regions.
You have been doing that, you say? Now, I think I missed your comment. Are you actually switching your RDs?
For a period of months.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Not permanently.
Yeah. Good. Any other comments?
I was just going to say that I think the problem in my mind is not one of overseas, but in the States. I don't sense any greater separation in terms of my going overseas in the future or any less knowledge of what's happening there. But the problem is the boundaries within the States.
Do you have any thoughts on how we could work on this?
Well,
anybody? I didn't mean to interrupt you, Al, maybe. Do you want to comment on that? Or?
Well, I was just thinking, the only thing I can think of is better communication in terms of, with regard to the division,
Yes.
I was thinking that there's almost nothing like personal contact, you know, face to face and eye to eye. And things like this have given meaning and appreciation in other divisions. And also at our Western Division, the staff conference, we had Skip Gray come and speak. And that was a real help to me in understanding the Southern Division.
Yes.
Much better than papers circulating.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a good point.
I think in the future it would be really helpful to have sessions like this where people come from a multitude of the divisions for a kind of a debriefing here from you all. This has been a real education for me this week.
Good. Doug?
I have two comments. One of them probably is unrealistic, but I think the headquarters staff, Jim and yourself and Lauren coming around, I think they really add a lot to balance and communication. I know that's limited how much y'all can get around, but that sure helps. And the other is I think having other staff men from other divisions come to weekend, week-long conferences to speak or to take part would really make a difference. And I know that's an added financial cost, but I think it'd be worth it.
Uh-huh.
You know, to just to bring staff men to, like every week-long conference, each region have, maybe just to have someone from another division there, because you know someday they may be there anyway. I think it'd be worth the cost just for communication.
Good. Some good ideas here.
I think another, Rod, is that in each division, I think there are a few people who can articulate the strengths of that division and at the same time have capacity for ministry responsibility that we could trade off at brigade level or RD level, people who can be a part of another division and infuse the ideas of that division. And I view the thing as rather than having it being a detriment that there are so many variances of views as a an asset.
Right.
And that what needs to be done is bringing together of these things and taking the best from everybody, and we all benefit from it.
Yeah, good. Now,
I'd like to ask him what he means by brigade.
A fellow who can coordinate in multi-area ministry responsibility, like Dan has four places in L.A., someone like that.
Dan, you want to comment?
Well, not a new suggestion. Could we have maybe two or three people from one division attend another division's staff conference?
Mm-hmm.
Since everybody can get together, maybe we can select some. The other thing would be a possibility of a staff journal, maybe a quarterly journal in which papers were submitted from various divisions and then circulated to the whole staff.
All right. Bruce?
Several years ago in the Southwest, Walt encouraged us to correspond with someone in another, in an area work in another region or division and move in with them for a week and live with the area rep, observe firsthand.
Sure, you could take your annual vacation.
No, thank you. It seems it might be easier to move PARs around and area reps and regional directors and contact point level people. I would suggest that some of our top PARs get cross training in other divisions. I know my training has been in three different divisions. It's just a chance, kind of a freak thing, but it sure helped me to understand a lot of different things.
Good.
I'm going to suggest the same thing, but maybe a little bit different idea. I think sometimes the friction comes where we send them to infuse ideas rather than to go to learn.
Yeah,
that's
a good point. Okay. let's see. All right, let's go on to the next one. This is number two under staff appointments. A divisional director selects and or dismisses his own leadership team subject to approval by the president. What's the principle you see here? We see the principle of decentralization, obviously. What else?
Job security for the president.
Well, except that the board of directors appoints the president.
Who appoints the board of directors?
Well,
God.
Yeah, right. There it is. God appoints them. They are elected for intervals and then rotate off the board at the end of their three-year interval. The way we're set up now, the board elects its own officers and its own board members. Several years ago, we had bylaws which prescribed that the board members were elected by the navigator staff. And we tried to work this out, but there were some staff members who felt that it wasn't all that realistic, and it was more ritualistic, and so we moved away from that. But Lauren feels rather strongly that the navigator staff ought to have a say in who the board of directors are. And I don't know when we're going to be changing our policy, but I would imagine that this policy could very well be changed in the near future, so that you would actually be electing the board of directors, and then the board, of course, elects its own officers.
Can you tell us who the board of directors are?
Yes. We have some outside board members, and by outside we mean non-staff, and then staff members on the board. And so we have an outside-inside board. Some organizations have a purely outside board and some purely inside. And there are lots of arguments, pro and con, on both sides of the fence. Our board consists of Bob Hage, who is one of the vice presidents at McDonnell Douglas, and Dan Pyatt, who directs an independent organization involved in translation worldwide. Dan was on our staff, as you may know, and ran the work in Europe for a number of years. Bob Foster, who has been on the Navigator staff, is a member of the board of directors and runs Lost Valley Ranch here in Colorado. Lila is a member of the board. Skip is a member. Doug Sparks is a member. Jim Downing. Jerry Bridges. Let's see, who am I forgetting? Lauren, Sandy, and myself. It seems like I'm overlooking somebody.
Gene War.
No, Gene War is not on the board. Mayhall is not. He will be eventually. We eventually plan to have various DDs on the board. And of course, one of the things that Lauren is facing now is how can we have an international board of directors, and how can we give adequate representation on an international board to countries around the world who are becoming more and more prominent and significant in the Navigator ministry. So one of the thoughts he's had is that when a country becomes a sending country, then it would be possible for them to have someone on the international board of directors. So we probably might end up with a board of directors for the American ministries and then another board that would be an international board. Charlie?
Could you tell us Lauren's reasons for having the NASDAQ elect the board?
Well, this was one of several alternatives when the Navigators were incorporated. This was one legal way of having a board of directors elected, and it seemed very democratic, and so this was the way in which Dawson set it up. And in those days, the board was elected by the membership, by the staff. And we continued this process, but one year here, maybe 10 years ago, some of the staff just reacted to this, and they felt that it was sort of a ritualistic thing, and why didn't the board just go ahead and elect their own board members? And this, of course, satisfies the legal requirements, both state and federal. So we moved to that position. One of the reasons for having a process of any kind, of course, is to satisfy federal and state regulations. And does that get at your question?
Well, I heard once that it was because he was sort of afraid that the big liberal movement board, you know, they always get all the property and the land, and, you know, the ones who go the right way get nothing, except the people.
I think Lauren's thinking on that at this time is that we are not anywhere near facing that problem, and that our staff, you know, on a worldwide basis is very loyal to the navigators, and we're not beginning to get liberal elements, etc. And it doesn't strike us as a real problem at the present.
Wasn't the idea that in the future, if the higher leadership, usually in a movement, it's not the people in the field, it's the liberal law-based people in a higher position.
Yes. So that the staff could resolve the problem. Yeah.
Could you explain some differences in responsibility of the board of directors and the DEs?
Well, the board of directors is the final authority in the navigator work, and there's a sense in which Lauren works for the board of directors. And when we had our board of directors meeting, when the board said, we think that too much money is being invested in recreational facilities, well, we had to say, well, you know, you're the boss. So there's the final authority, in a real sense, is with that board of directors. And the primary function of the board is to review what is being done. It's also for appeal. We can appeal to the board for various reasons, and there are legally constituted authority for the navigators. Let's see. We need to get back to this policy here on a divisional director selecting or dismissing his own leadership team. We need to talk about what's another principle here. Decentralization is one. Maybe to move it along faster, I could simply say that one of the things that we have in mind behind this policy is that a man must learn to live with his own decisions. And if he hires someone, then that's his decision. And if they don't work out, and if there are problems, he also then has the responsibility of discharging them. But we want him to live with that decision. The first step is to make the right decision. And after you've made your decision, then you have a job, the task of making the decision work out, making the decision right. And when you've made the decision, you have a lot more motivation to make that decision work out, to make it workable, to resolve those snarls that might be in it, to straighten them out and make it workable. For instance, if we make a decision here to send a man to Joe Simmons, the man arrives on the field, Joe works with him a few weeks, and he begins to think, well, how come those guys sent me this meathead? I'm going to send him back. And he writes back and he says, I want to send this guy back. But if we use this other process where the man selects his own team, we send Joe some personnel forms and we say, here, take your choice. There's three or four alternatives. Joe makes his decision. He says, send me Charlie. So we send him Charlie. Charlie gets on the field and Joe works with him a few weeks and he says, boy, Charlie's really got some problems here. We're going to have to go to work on Charlie and help him with these problems. See, it's Joe's decision. He wants to work it out. He wants to straighten out the problems, to make the problem, to make the decision work right. So this is one of the reasons. Number three, the president selects and or dismisses his own leadership team subject to to approval by the board of directors. One of the thoughts here is that everyone is subject to someone. Another thought is that this gives the board an opportunity to review the decision of the president. And if the president, for instance, if sometime in the navigator future there's a president in the navigators that begins to go off the deep end, say doctrinally, and he begins to bring into the leadership team of the navigators men whose thinking along those doctrinal lines correspond with his, then the board could take a look at that and they could say, no, we don't want that man, we don't want that man. You'll have to get somebody whose thinking and convictions are different, or maybe the board would have to end up removing the president. When a new president takes over, then it should be the new president's privilege to select his own leadership team. And those of us who are, say, a part of Lauren's leadership team, we should not assume that a new president will select us to remain in our present responsibilities. But that man would be free to select his own leadership team. And that would be an important time, of course, for the board of directors to review those men and to make sure that that leadership team is a group of men whose gifts complement one another, not just a group of men who maybe all like to go skiing or all like to go fishing or have an affinity for one another, but a team whose gifts will provide the kind of leadership that are needed in the Navigators at that time.
Doug? And how long is the president appointed for?
Pardon?
What is the time factor of appointment?
3 years.
3 years?
Yes. And then the board re-elects the president or a new one at the end of that 3-year period. On number 4, the president is appointed or removed by the board of directors. Why do you think this policy exists? What would be the principle behind this? We've had an occasion or two in the history of the United States when this policy would have been a good policy to have had in existence. You see if... Okay.
So that no single person could take the power? There would be no reason to say that one president took the power or acceded the power.
I see what you're saying, yeah. Okay. The thought that I had, Craig, do you want to...
Any set of problems, whether it's right. A series of bad problems, incapable of the economist, a number of things.
Uh-huh, right. That would be one of the... That'd be a chief reason right there. Okay, number 5. Dismissal of a representative from the Navigator staff requires the approval of the president. Okay, Chuck? All right.
Security for each individual representative, knowing that the president has to approve his dismissal.
So it's extra. It's protection for the individual, isn't it? It provides protection against the bias of a DD or an RD. If you get transferred into a new division and you somehow have all sorts of conflicts and problems with an RD or a DD, and so they decide the simplest thing to do is to send you over to another organization and they want to give you a pink slip and your walking papers, if it weren't for a policy like this, they could do that. And you might have spent 15 years with the Navigators and all of a sudden, it's over. So this policy provides protection for the individual.
If a area representative was dismissed by a DD, and no other DDs wanted to take that area representative, would he be in fact fired? Could Monsanto say, DD, take this area representative? What would happen then?
Well, I think that if Lauren felt that there was not a good justification for dismissing the man from the organization, that he would then find a place for him. Very strong. Yes, Lauren might see very good reasons why the man should not stay in that particular division or region. But on the other hand, he would probably see that the man's usefulness could be very great somewhere else. And that would be a man, it would be a case of finding just the right place for that man to be. All right, supervisory titles, like regional director, are used to describe one's sphere of responsibility and may change with a new assignment. What are we trying to say here?
We're all area representatives.
Well, you don't want the regional director to feel like he's fired if he does move to another situation.
Yes, and we also want... Go ahead.
We want to avoid attaching too much importance to a title.
Yes. We want all of us to be mindful of the fact that our titles in the organization, like regional director or whatever they might be, are for the purpose of fulfilling a task and getting a job done, and that just because we have aspired to a certain level doesn't mean that in our next assignment, if it's for the benefit of the organization, that we would be willing then, as Ron York has, who left the Southern Division as an RD and has gone to work in the Orient, not as an RD, but more as an area rep or a super area rep, however you want to state it, so that we can move up and down any kind of ladder that we have and not feel that this is an indication that we failed. Yes.
Do you anticipate that number 5 may be changed? In other words, I look at 1 and 5, and it's obvious it's easier to get hired than fired. Will that eventually, both those decisions lie at the same level, do you think?
No, I think that 5 will probably not be changed because of the protection angle for the individual. what we want to see here, if a divisional director feels that a man should be dismissed from the Navigators, we want that decision to be reviewed, but we want the divisional director to do the task of allowing him to go. You know, he doesn't send the man to headquarters and say, okay, Sandy, fire him, but he checks his decision, he goes over the reasons with Lauren. Lauren says, yes, he says, I feel that this is the right decision. We ought to let this man go. Then the DD still is the one, if he's the one who fired him, he's the one then who ought to let him go. Or even if he's come into his division from another division, he still is the one who lays the pink slip on him, so to speak.
This is if he was fired from the Navigator organization.
Right.
And he can't be fired from the division. And still, the DD has that prerogative.
If he were to, lop off his head from the division with no provision for him to go anywhere else, that in effect would be the same thing as kicking him out of the organization. So he would have to have negotiated for another job slot somewhere in the organization before he could have moved him out.
That would be the DD's responsibility to negotiate?
Yes, I think that it would eventually... Well, it may not be his responsibility to negotiate, but he would not be free to fire the man so that he would no longer be a navigator. He'd probably come to Sandy and say, this man just doesn't fit in the division. We don't have a job for him, or his gifts don't fit any of the things that we're doing, and we just feel that he needs to be somewhere else, either out of the navigators or in another division, maybe at headquarters. You know, we get lots of those. How do you think we got here? Craig?
Brought back on the first one there, appointees, appointments. Would you project that, given a few years,
I don't know. I don't know whether it will or not. We haven't discussed this in any of our sessions, at least none of the ones I've been in. I suppose that depends on how large we get and how we're organized. Okay, could we go to the next section? This is on representatives sent overseas. And in case you can't read that top line, I'll read it for you. Geographical allotments overseas are approved by the president. The reason behind this is that someone has to be ultimately responsible for our overall strategy. And our chief resource in the Navigators is our manpower, our men, and therefore this is the key to the development of our work. And someone needs to be in a position where they can identify our best opportunities. So it's a combination of these, working out the strategy, which of course is top-level responsibility, and discovering where these our best opportunities are, and assigning personnel or approving geographical slots to best opportunities. And this was one of the reasons that Lauren wanted to see Scotty back here at headquarters, because we feel that one of Scotty's strengths will be to help us develop a worldwide strategy for the development of Navigator Ministries. And then geographical allotments will be based on this strategy. It'll provide a lot of information that Lauren can use for making those decisions. So we need to identify our best opportunities. That is, where can we place men? What countries of the world that will produce the best results in accomplishing our objectives? Any question on that one? I might add here in this section on the selection of personnel that these policies were developed several months ago, and we have been following these policies long enough now to discover some of the main problems. And one of the problems that we're struggling with here is the time element. That we're losing time, we're not getting our decisions made as promptly. There are various points through this whole set of policies where we're getting hung up. And time is a problem, communications are a problem, and uncertainty is a problem. And we are reworking these policies, and we reworked the whole set of policies and then discussed them with the DDs last week, and some of the ideas were adopted and some were a little too radical, so it's back to the drawing boards on those. But we are working on a revision of these that we think will help us resolve these three problems of time and communications and uncertainty. On item number two, overseas personnel needs are to be circulated to each divisional director along with all necessary information, including any requests of the potential supervisor. Now, we're really talking here about job descriptions. We're sending out job descriptions on the geographical allocations that Lauren has already approved. The names of the qualified men then are submitted to headquarters.
Right on the point, too. In fact, though, we are sending them to the RD level now. That's been changed a little bit.
All right. Now, what is the principle that you can see behind these two, numbers 2 and 3?
It seems like they would know more of the personnel available rather than central.
Right. They are in touch with the people. And the principle we're after here is matching a man's gifts to the opportunity. We want the best man that we have available in that assignment. And years ago, these decisions used to be made here at headquarters, but that was at a time when we knew most of the people in the Navigators. And of course, we reached the time when we realized that we were making decisions on people that sometimes only one or two people on the personnel board knew. And so the whole process was decentralized. And there are some ideas that we have in mind for perhaps even decentralizing it a little further. But here, the principle we're after here is the best man in that job slot. On the next one, number 4, Headquarters provides all necessary personnel information to the receiving supervisor with copies to his divisional director. Oh, there are several principles here. One is decentralization. Another is that this helps get the decision-making done out there on the field so that the man who makes the decision is also going to help make that decision work out. We're contemplating the possible policy of having a receiving supervisor travel to the sending country when he is in doubt about the people that are being sent. If he has his personnel forms and he reads them through and he just can't seem to come to a decision, then as a last alternative, we would have him come to the States perhaps, or the sending country, and interview the people.
What percent of reps go overseas without ever having met their new supervisor in the receiving country?
Well, Bob, do you know what percentage of reps would go over?
I don't have an accurate figure on that at all. It seems to me that would be a problem someone needs to resolve without even knowing the person you're going to be under, the person supervisor, not even having met the person who's going to be supervised.
It could be up to even half. They don't really know each other, but they may have met each other. They're not total strangers.
At what level now is the decision being made on who goes overseas?
Missions.
Divisional level? Who, in fact, is making that decision? Right. The receiving supervisor, whether he is an RD or a DD or perhaps even an AR, is making the decision on who goes overseas. And that is, you know, that is a rather fantastic step of decentralization. Yes, he selects from personnel forms and information that he receives from headquarters, and he makes his decision based on that information, or if he feels that he does not have sufficient information, he writes for more. And in a case or two, when we felt it was necessary, we've already done this. We've already had the receiving supervisor come in and do some interviews personally. No.
Every name that's sent to headquarters goes to the RD.
We are not doing any screening here. All the names that are turned in by the divisions, whether they're from the States or other parts of the world, they're all sent out to the receiving supervisor. This, I think, points up one of the problems that we have, and that is the problem of getting all this personnel information and keeping it up to date here at headquarters. And this is difficult to both get that information and then also keep it up to date. And you may feel sometimes as though you're being plagued by headquarters for personnel information, but it's essential. We have to have it. There's no way in which we can operate without it unless we completely change our procedures. So it's very, very vital information. Let's see. Dan, you had your hand up.
Can't personnel forms be deceiving or just paper evaluation?
Scotty and Doug both feel that our personnel forms and the information they get in most cases gives them the information that they need, and they feel that they're able to make good decisions based on that information. Scotty feels very strongly about this. Yes, it can be deceiving, but thus far we've felt like we've been getting awfully good information, and apparently the results, you know, after they've made their decisions and evaluated their decisions and lived with their decisions a while, they're coming back and they're saying, yes, this system is working. Yes. We have devised new forms, and the new form does not cover all of the stable information that a person filled out when they filled out their first form. It just has to do with recent information and changes, areas where the information would naturally change over a period of 2 or 3 years. So we're trying to simplify the process. Craig?
Making the needs known at the lowest level possible and allowing men to be aware of the needs to make a, say, initiative or indicate an interest in that particular thing because they're only by themselves.
This was one of the policies that we recommended last week to the DDs, that the job slots be published right on down to the contact point level. And so this is being considered at the present time. They are evaluating this, and they're going to give it some thought and talk it over with the RDs, and then they're going to give us their reaction to that proposal.
Just want to follow on that. You know, it seems helpful to me sometimes when I see some of these just to see what we're shooting for in people. You know, it helps us in evaluation of our own areas.
Uh-huh.
We see so many job slots.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Rod, could you clarify on the forms? There are forms that our supervisors fill out on us. Is that correct?
Yes.
Overseas. How many forms, how many supervisors, for example, would 3 forms by 3 supervisors over the past 5 years, or the latest form, or could you explain that? In other words, what actually do they see?
Bob, would you explain that for us? What's the process?
Well, yeah, it's usually one form. There are some situations where, say, a person has recently moved from one region to another, you might get 2. But it's usually his latest supervisor, unless he's brand new in it and feels he doesn't know the person well enough, then, of course, the older supervisor would give the evaluation. But it's usually the latest.
Plus,
unless special circumstances would require more.
What about the one he filled out?
The profile?
Yeah.
What's the question on that?
Does that also go overseas?
Oh, yes, both do. The evaluation and the profile, both.
So there's
they have to
forms.
Do it. Yes, they at least have 2 forms on every person.
Yeah. And we feel that if a form is an if an evaluation is too old, it'll probably give some misinformation about a man and might put him, you know, might put him in a bad light. So we try to keep those evaluation forms up to date. So we don't send all the old ones, we just send the up to date ones because we think that that's much better information. Now, at the end of this session, Bob has some forms here and the names of some of you who we need some information on. And if you would get those forms from Bob and fill those out before you go to lunch. If you'd fill them out and leave them with Bob or leave them in the conference office here before you head home this weekend, why, this would be very helpful to us. All right. Number 5, the receiving supervisor informs headquarters of his number 1 and number 2 choices. One of the principles here is that a man is, again, selecting his own team. He's making the decision. The number 2 choice is an effort to save time. And this doesn't always happen. And here's one of the places where we lose some time because they usually select one man and say, I want so-and-so. But if number 1 choice doesn't make the decision, then we lose time going back and saying, well, who's your number 2 choice? So if you're ever in that slot, try to make both choices at the same time. On number 6, the number 1 choice is then informed by the DD and asked to pray about accepting the assignment. We're interested here in discovering God's will. And this is one more checkpoint in discovering whether or not we really have God's will in the assignment of an individual to overseas. For instance, several years ago, we selected a man who was an area rep in the United States for a particular country in EMMA. And Sani and several of us here at headquarters were convinced, along with the receiving division, that this man was ideal for that job slot. And we presented it to him and asked if he and his wife would pray about it and let us know their decision. So 2 or 3 weeks later, we got a letter from Bill saying, "Nope, I'm not the man for the job, and here are my reasons." Well, we wrote back to him and we said, "Well, now on reason one, so and so and so and so. Reason two, so and so and so and so." We shot his reasons down in flames. And we said, "Now we want you and your wife to pray about this and let us know what your decision is." So they wrote back again in 2 or 3 weeks and they said, "No, we just don't have peace in our hearts about this. We don't think this is the way that God is leading." And so 2 or 3 of us here at headquarters just individually wrote this man, not as an official word, but we wrote and we said, "Well, now you're reasoning on this point and that point, you know, you are the man." And 2 or 3 months passed, you know, in the process. And finally, we came to the place where we accepted his word. And we finally believed, as he did, that God was not giving him freedom in his heart to accept that assignment. And then we went in, and we began to, or Lauren began to think in terms of who would be an alternative. And all of a sudden, someone came to mind, and he was a man who we just couldn't spare, in fact, and that was the reason we probably hadn't thought of him in the first place. And we presented it to him, and I mean, the green lights went on all over the world. And that man is in that job slot now. He's been there several years. He's doing a beautiful job. So this is one more way for us to determine or to discover that it's the Holy Spirit who is sending the man, not the personnel board or the DDs or Lauren Sani. And our verse on this is Acts 13:4. We want to be sure that the Holy Spirit is the one that's sending the people out. On number 7, if the number 1 choice accepts the assignment, his transfer from a U.S. to an overseas division will then be coordinated by the personnel department, and the executive vice president will make any new decisions pertinent to his move. For instance, the sending division might say, "Man, they want him in September, and we can't let him go until December." And the receiving decision, our division, says, "Well, language school starts in October. We've got to have him in September." So who's going to make the decision? The sending division or the receiving division? No. Someone who is totally impartial. And so that's what we're after here, is an impartial, objective decision on how we resolve that conflict. Number 8 doesn't need comment. Number 9, sufficient lead time should be given so that the decision can be finalized at least 6 months before the departure. The thing we're after here is orderliness and timeliness and adequate time. Last minute personnel decisions are inefficient and they create pressure on people all around. And we're still trying to develop a system so that our personnel decisions can be made further in advance. And one of our new policies is that each year when we get together for one of our main divisional directors conferences, this worldwide, like in December, all the guys are going to come with their personnel needs for 2 years. And if we can get this thing projected down the road 2 years and begin to work on those decisions so that the decision-making process is at work over a 2-year plan, we can solve a lot of the problems we're having now because of time. Yes, Lauren approves the geographical slots. And that's part of our whole personnel process, is to get these approvals far enough down the road so that they're firm. Now, most of our personnel assignments, as you know, are already all filled for 1973. And we are making some significant progress in achieving this. But we're still trying to stretch it out. And when we get together in December, we'll be approving geographical slots for 74 and 75.
What happens, let's say, if in a certain country the Spirit of God really seems to be working, and it's like, well, Sandy recently allocated 2 more slots for England. Is there room for that kind of flexibility in the system?
Yes, there is flexibility in the system. One of the guidelines that we follow that comes out later here in the paper is that 50% of our representatives will go to overseas assignments. That's not only true for the United States, but that's every sending country after they've produced their third. Then from then on, every other representative goes overseas. So this gives us some flexibility. We have a quota that we'll be able to send over to other countries every year. And we can of course, that's a bit flexible. There's flexibility within that. Let's go on here to this next set of policies and quickly look at some of these. Let's see. We didn't discuss it, but on the previous page, we said that only men who have qualified as area representatives will be appointed as overseas representatives. Then on this page, we're making an exception under 302, number parentheses 1A. It says, when sending supervisor and receiving supervisors both believe that the person assigned has a reasonable chance of success in the assignment. This is an exception to our policy, and an illustration of that is Tom Einen, who went to Taiwan to fill a job slot there. But to both the sending and the receiving supervisors felt that this man was qualified and could do the job, and so we made an exception to the policy. And there are always, there are always times when a policy might be accepted. But the person then who makes an exception to the policy, who approves the exception, is the one who makes the policy. If you have a divisional policy and you want an exception to it, then your divisional leader, if he made the policy, he should be the one who approves it. If you've got a policy in your area that your area rep made, then he should be able to approve an exception to the policy. B, it says, when the sending division and the receiving divisional director both believe that this is the best next step in the man's total career plan. What we're saying here is that we're concerned with the worth of the individual and that the need of the organization is secondary to the need of the individual. Whatever is best for the man himself is our primary concern. We only have about 5 minutes. I think that as I read down through these, I think that many of these other policies are rather self-explanatory. Under reassignment B, where we say regional directors or potential regional directors will be career planned by the president, the president is responsible for the management of the organization, and RDs are the key to the future management of the organization. Therefore, he wants to be involved in the career planning of RDs. That's a very important consideration. So why don't we conclude with that?